This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. These days, that same heartfelt message might arrive as LU4ENA. For anyone not versed in text, that's love you forever and always. Texting is condemned in some quarters as the end of language as we know it, the end of civilization even, and yet we'd wager that your thumbs dance on a keyboard in lieu of email, the handwritten note, or even actual speech, at least from time to time. And language junkies, rest easy. Renowned linguist David Crystal maintains that texting retains standard grammar, that most of that shorthand has been around for decades, if not centuries, and that far from debasing the language, texting invigorates it. His new book is called Texting, The Great Debate. If you'd like to SMS that title to someone, that's fine. It's already written in texting shorthand. Later in the hour, David Gergen joins us to reminisce about what it's like to work for one party's president and then for another's. But first, David Crystal joins us. If you'd like to challenge his argument, our phone number is 800-989-8255. And emailers, what is your favorite texting shorthand? The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also reach us on Twitter. You can find us at twitter.com/TOTN. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. David Crystal joins us from the studio in his home in North Wales. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today. And yes, we sometimes do call the show TOTN or even TOTN.
Hello, Neil. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
It's a couple of letters and numbers strung together. Why the moral panic over the shorthand used in texting?
It's amazing, isn't it? I've never come across such a moral panic ever in all my poor linguistic life. And it's because people imagine things about texting which, without any evidence at all, really, just because they hear some kids, like you did on your trail a few minutes ago, shouting out a few abbreviations here and there, they think that these are entirely used in texting, that text messages consist of nothing else but these abbreviations. In actual fact, when you do some analysis, like I had to do for the book, I collected, you know, thousands and thousands of these things and went through them. Do you know what proportion of words are actually abbreviated in text messages? It's less than 10% on average. So they aren't used as often as people think they are. And that's why it isn't such a big deal.
And there are still nouns and verbs. They're still in recognizable structures.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when somebody says, see you later, and they spell it with a C for the C and a U for the U, and later becomes L and then number 8 and so on. Well, of course, that's a natural kind of tendency to abbreviate the words because it's quite awkward to text with your fingers on those mobile phones, these cell phones, and it takes you a while. So naturally, you get a bit of that. But when you think about it, how often are we going to say, see you later, see you later, see you later to everybody? Most of the time when we're texting each other, we're actually talking rather more complicated messages, more sensible messages, and the abbreviations simply don't work there because they would be too ambiguous. And so as a result, there's always a combination of abbreviation and real language in a text message. And the proportion, as I say, is that the majority of it is actually in standard English.
And the other part of it that I think drives people crazy is the idea that these are, you know, unrecognizable hieroglyphs. You quote somebody as saying that in your book. Nevertheless, yeah. Not, of course, hieroglyphs is not actually the metaphor is not appropriate. But nevertheless, that these emoticons and these kinds of expressions are taking over from real words.
Well, there are not that many of them, actually. I mean, just because some of them are used quite frequently, people again get this impression that there's thousands and thousands of them. There aren't. When you actually start collecting them all, as I had to do for this book, you end up with a few, really just a few dozen that are common. And of course, people do play with some artistic ones from time to time and make emoticons look like Homer Simpson and things like that, you know. But the common ones are actually very, very few indeed. When you trace them back, you know, if you go to the big Oxford English Dictionary, you'll find that an awful lot of these abbreviated forms have got a real history. As you mentioned in your introduction, Queen Victoria, you know, used to play games, rebuses they were called, not hieroglyphs, you're right, the term was rebus in those days. And she used to play games where she and her family would test each other with these little abbreviated words. I mean, you get things like this. You get a number 2, a little buzzy bee, the thing you drive a rowing boat with, another number 2, a piece of string all tied up, and then another number 2, and then another little buzzy bee, and you have to work it out. And it says 2B or not to be. And that kind of puzzle goes back hundreds of years. So people were actually abbreviating the language in this way long before cell phones were even invented.
Old people like me would remember the game Concentration that Hugh Downs used to host, where indeed you had to solve such rebuses every day on a half-hour quiz show on television here in this country. I'm sure there were games like that that were on the television there in Wales as well. Another thing that people have trouble with, though, is the loss of vowels in a lot of words.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a line I often see used around. If you take a sentence and leave the vowels out, actually people can understand it. You know, people can understand it. It's because vowels don't carry very much information in language, and the consonants carry all the information. Wouldn't work the other way around. If you left all the consonants out and just had the vowels left, oh, that would be a real disaster. You wouldn't understand a word. So actually what the kids are doing is they're instinctively recognizing a basic fact about the nature of human language, and that is the information is in the consonants.
The information is in the consonants, and indeed, I think I may be wrong, but doesn't the expression okay go back to Morse code and the railroads?
Oh, the history of okay is a long, long history. Lots of different views about where it came from actually. But that kind of abbreviation is also very, very typical. And notice with an example like that, indirectly, we're making a different point now, and that is that an awful lot of adults abbreviate too. And in fact, when you think of all the text messages that are circling around our globe at the moment, and you quantify them insofar as it's possible to do that, the interesting fact emerges that only about 20% of these messages are actually between kids. 80% of them are between adults, and indeed corporate organizations of one kind and another. We're talking here about people like, you know, Barack Obama text messaging all his party supporters. We're talking about stock exchanges text messaging their members. And I guess we're talking about NPR offering text as an opportunity for people to get in touch with them. So an awful lot of the texts that are out there are between adults. And in many cases, abbreviations are not just disincentivized, they're actually banned because people are aware that abbreviations can be quite ambiguous sometimes.
We're talking with David Crystal about his new book, Texting the Great Debate. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. And if you do text, what's your favorite shorthand expression? Email us, talk@npr.org. And Jonathan's on the line. Jonathan calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi. My comment is a personal pet peeve, and I'd just like to get some comments on it as well. And that is when people start using the text abbreviations in everyday conversation. I work with several people who use LOL if someone says something humorous, and another one is notorious for saying BTW.
By the way?
By the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just figuring that out. David Crystal, that does happen.
Yeah. Now, the question is, though, make a long list of these. And everybody thinks of LOL. Hey, yeah, lol, that's cool. You know, I mean, you do hear that a fair bit. And you get BTW and you get BRB for be right back. And if you think very, very hard, you might get up to 4 or 5 or 6 of these. But you won't get 50 or 60 or 70 of them. You know, most of these abbreviations are not coming into everyday speech. Just a couple are. And everybody feels that they're quite cool and they use them. And they may last for a while or they may just disappear from the language. But they're not as frequent as all that. They're really a very tiny, tiny feature of the sort of cool speech that some of the youngsters use.
Jonathan, what drives you nuts about it?
In particular, BTW, the fact that it takes more time to say that than to say, by the way.
Ah.
Well, yes, that's true. And it's surprising, isn't it, that people actually will expend that little bit of extra energy. This is really quite the contrary of text messaging, which is there to save energy. But, you know, it's not the only thing like that. I mean, if we say write to www. I mean, that's a real mouthful.
Tell me
so when
about
something
it.
Becomes very useful, people actually will spend that bit of extra energy.
Jonathan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to, this is Paul, and Paul's on the line with us from Lansing in Michigan.
Yeah, I'm legally blind, and I have read and wrote Braille for quite a number of years, most of my life, and Braille is replete with short forms and acronyms. In fact, sometimes we get so involved in the short forms of words and signs, they're called, that we forget how to spell what we call the long form, which is the word spelled out.
Which we would call English.
Yeah, and so I don't find this a bit at all unusual. In fact, when my niece got married, she married a real computer wonk, and I offered to teach him how to read and write Braille, and he declined. But I think now that he's a little older and wiser, he might just take me up on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very nice example. Thanks for that, Paul. It reminds me, of course, that another one of the big features of text messaging for a large sector of the population is that it's provided suddenly an amazingly fresh means of communication for people who are deaf. Because, of course, telephones had, have traditionally not been available. And now suddenly text messaging is opening up all kinds of opportunities for them.
You know, you raise an interesting point. I have a friend in Ann Arbor who's totally blind, and he has a deaf daughter who sees, and when he wants to communicate with her, he signs with his hands, and she writes back to him on the computer, which is equipped with JAWS, which is a speech program.
Yeah.
And they've done this all of their lives, all of her life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a marvelous example, and it illustrates the way in which a new technology, which was originally designed for one set of functions, suddenly opens up opportunities for in a quite unexpected directions.
Exactly.
Paul, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
We're going to continue our conversation with David Crystal about his book, Texting, the Great Debate, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Is it debasing the language? And, well, even so, if you have a favorite shorthand expression, why don't you zap it to us by email? The address is talk@npr.org. We got this from Marshall in Fort Bragg, California. My favorite text word is IMHO in my humble opinion. Love the show, he writes. Well, thank you very much for that. Again, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Stay with us. BRB. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We got this email from John in Flushing, Michigan. As I got ready to go into the OR to deliver my son Williams by C-section last May, I received my 82-year-old father's first text message, Free Willy. We're talking about text messaging this hour, that expedient little shorthand on our cell phones. We want to know what your favorite texting shortcut is. You can send us an email, talk@npr.org, or Twitter us at twitter.com/TOTN. Twitter user Vanilla Girl writes, I like NSFW, which is a bit silly since I work at home. I just think of it as not safe for the library if I'm using a terminal there. Linguist David Crystal is with us. His book is called Texting, the Great Debate. You can read an excerpt from it describing some of the myths about texting on our website at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. And I wonder, as you think about these text messages, a lot of them, well, were developed by kids. One of the favorites that we were reported by one of our employees here was POS, or parent over shoulder.
Yes, that's right. There are a lot of these, aren't they, which reflect the sort of the junior age range of the kids who really find this a very enthralling, exciting, innovative way of communicating. But, you know, we mustn't keep the conversation talking only about the basics here, these kind of everyday text abbreviations. What you have to remember is that you can actually develop the genre of texting so that it becomes really quite an artistic genre. You know, one of the first things that happened in the UK when this started, a little bit before it happened in the US, was that the Guardian newspaper started a text messaging poetry competition. And the idea was that you had 160 characters on your cell phone and you had to write a poem within those 160 characters. And you might think, That's not going to work. That's not going to produce anything sensible. In actual fact, there were some beautiful poems that came out of it. Some really evocative stuff, very moving stuff at times. People can succinctly express lovely ideas within the confines of a cell phone. And it illustrates the point that these abbreviations and the standard English that goes with it can actually be manipulated for some really quite artistic purposes.
Let's get another caller on the line, and let's talk with Philip. Philip with us from Detroit in Michigan.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I just was wondering if Mr. Crystal has studied texting in other languages. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Philip.
Yeah, Philip, thanks for the question. Yes, I certainly did. In the book, Texting the Great Debate, I've actually got at the back lists of text messaging abbreviations in about a dozen other languages.
My favorites are Welsh.
Well, good for you, Neil. That's, seeing as I'm speaking from Wales, I appreciate that. The interesting thing I found out, though, was that exactly the same processes of abbreviation are turning up in all these other languages. So, for example, you know the one that's in English where you replace a syllable by a numeral, like in later, where the numeral 8 appears in the middle of the word? You'll find that in all the other languages, too. For example, in Spanish, a common text abbreviation for saludos is SL. Two, where two equals dos, of course. And in French, you get the word cassette, where you get K7, because seven is set in French. And in German, you can say gute Nacht, and it's N8, because eight is acht in German. And so you can go on. And so the same sorts of things are happening in these different languages. It's really fascinating.
That suggests that these kinds of things are universal.
It does indeed. Within the confines of the alphabet you're using, of course. I mean, when you go to Chinese and Japanese and so on, you find some different things happening there. And in Arabic, you know, because of the different nature of the writing systems. But for any country that uses any language, it uses the Roman alphabet, you do get some universal properties turning up.
Let's see if we can turn now to Michael. And Michael's calling us from Chico in California.
Hello there.
Hi.
Great show. I got two for you. T backslash Y.
T backslash Y. Forgive me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
And the other is TCGH and PBWY.
I suspect it has nothing to do with the state of Wyoming.
Nothing. It means take care, good health, and peace be with you.
Ah, that's a lovely way to express that.
I've long handed for years. Now I just do that.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Here's an email, and obviously we're talking about a system of messaging that developed in what we now call second-generation mobiles there in the UK, or cell phones here in the United States. Here's an email question from Vienne in San Jose, California. What do you think will be the effect of QWERTY keypads on texting, such as those found on BlackBerries and iPhones, or third-generation phones?
Well, of course, the interesting thing about lots of the abbreviations that turn up in text messaging is that they were there before. They were there before in chat rooms. You can trace some of them back on the internet, back to the early 1980s, really. Any medium where typing is fast and you want to get something across quite quickly, then you'll find these abbreviations turning up. Now, the fact that we've got new technologies coming along, like the BlackBerry and so on, which allows you to use that fuller keyboard. What you have to remember always is, how is the message going to appear at the other end? If it's going to appear on a cell phone in a very shorthand sort of way, then it doesn't look too bad. But if you treat your BlackBerry as if it's a cell phone and type in all these abbreviations, and out they come onto a computer screen as an email where there's no constraint of space at all, then it starts to look rather weird. And so people have to manage these different technologies and realize not just how they're used from the point of view of the user, but how they're used from the point of view of the viewer at the other end.
For example, on cell phones, it's easy to drop the apostrophe and you don't lose a lot of meaning. On an iPhone, it might look kind of silly.
Yeah, that's right. But here's an interesting fact, Neil. And when I was doing that survey for the book, I found actually that over half the texters, and I include young people here, actually took the trouble to put the apostrophes in.
they're better at it than I am.
Well, I mean, that's quite difficult to do,
because
you've got to, go up to the top and find the punctuation marks and everything. And when I went to a school the other week and talked to a group of youngsters, these were sort of 16, 17-year-olds about this, they said, yeah, well, but But I mean, leaving all those abbreviations, putting those abbreviations in and leaving the punctuation out, that was something we did when we were younger. and you know, they say now we're a bit older. We text sensibly to each other. And there is obviously a maturational thing here, which has been very little studied yet.
Let's see if we can talk with Jimmy. Jimmy's calling us from Walla Walla in Washington.
Hi. I don't know. I personally agree with how text messaging can expand and enhance language. However, I don't necessarily see text messaging as expanding and enhancing English itself, per se, or, like, spoken English type of thing. Like, ASL is kind of its own form of dialectal English. American Sign Language or African Americans, it seems like, use BEV, I was reading somewhere, which is their own dialectal form of English. So what about that? Has text messaging developed its own grammar, per se, to where it's more of a dialect than...
Standard English.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. No, I don't think it has. Mind you, it's early days, isn't it? We're only talking about a technology that's been around for, well, you know, 5 to 10 years, really, for people to be using it. So it's early to say what impact it's going to have on the language as a whole in the long term. But so far, there's very little evidence of any real impact. You know, if you start counting up all these abbreviations, and indeed, if you counted up all the new words that have come into the internet to deal with that technology, words like, you know, menu and mouse and click and so on and so forth, you still only get a few hundred words, maybe 1,000 at most. And when you think that the English language has got 1 million words or more in it, this is just a drop in the ocean, really. So I'm not expecting the new technology to have a big impact on languages as such. But of course, in their own little world, they're producing quite an impact. If you think that, you know, half the world's population has got a cell phone now, and something like 2/3 of those people text, we're talking about a major phenomenon here.
Well, what about its impact on spelling and writing?
Well, nothing much yet, because what you have to remember is this. If it's cool to leave letters out and fashionable, then you've got to know that the letters are there in the first place in order to leave them out. In other words, the best texters are the best spellers.
As opposed to just the sound of a word?
Yeah, but you see, if you're going to be a good reader, you have to know about the relationship between letters and sounds. You've got to have a good phonetic sense. And I think one of the other things that texters are showing when they text well is that they have this phonetic sense. And this, you know, some recent research just came out in the UK, actually, just a few weeks ago, which showed that if you do literacy tests in schools, that the guys who produce the best literacy results are the people who do the most texting. In other words, the more you text, the better your literacy scores. And the reason is that texting gives you extra practice in reading and writing, even though it's on your mobile phone, doesn't matter. You're getting extra practice. And we all know that the more practice you get in reading, the better a reader you're going to be.
Jimmy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Gene in Hamilton, Ohio. During World War II, friends and I used to put SWAGBK on the outside of envelopes of letters sent to servicemen, sealed with a great big kiss.
And sealed with a loving kiss as well. Yes, I remember those. That illustrates the point perfectly, doesn't it? That each generation has got its favorite abbreviations. And these are the ones that are coming in with the present-day generation. They're new and they're cool and they're fresh and so on. Adults who criticize them should remember always that they did the same thing once upon a time.
And the research you did for this book suggests that, in fact, as more and more older people get into texting, well, they compose differently than kids. Men compose differently from women and boys from girls.
Yes, absolutely. This is one of the interesting things. It's so early days that it's difficult to be absolutely certain. But yes, there are big differences in style between males and females in text messaging. I mean, just take one tiny example out of dozens. Women use more exclamation marks when they text than men do. Make what you will of that. And women have more complex sentences on text messages than men do. Lots of differences of this kind. And as the age range goes up, you would expect a rather more conservative style to be used in text messaging, and that happens to an extent. But on the other hand, when older people, like your 82-year-old colleague from a little while ago, starts texting his grandchildren, he actually picks up some of those young abbreviations, and we all become children again.
Well, I think it's just because the men all studied Hemingway. That's the only reason.
Very likely.
Let's see if we can go to Phil. Phil's with us from Tempe in Arizona.
Hey, Neil, great show as always.
Thank you.
I think this is a fascinating conversation, and I'd like to hear your guest's observations on a phenomenon 20 years ago when the word like entered the popular vocabulary, as in, which, well, like, you know, and people predicted, you know, complete literary decline. Mm. And as the daughter of a 16-year-old, I must admit sometimes it does concern me a little bit in that there's a coarsening of, there's no subtlety of information. And so I'd be curious to hear your guests' thoughts and comparisons with texting.
David Crystal?
Yeah, sure. Well, listen, what irritates people with language is when something is overused. And if like is overused, then, of course, it gets irritating. But actually, it has a very specific function. In linguistics, you know, we call it a quotative. Because what it is, it's like a pair of quotation marks. If I say, I'm going to go like, then that's like opening a quotation mark to introduce the next point that's going to be said. And that sort of thing is a very useful feature in a conversation. It's a way of succinctly saying, I'm now going to refer to something that comes from somewhere else. Interestingly, you don't get that sort of thing in text messaging. People don't in text say things like, and you know, and you see, and I mean. These features of conversation are very much features of conversation and not features of the written medium.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're talking with David Crystal. His book is called Texting, the Great Debate. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Rob is on the line. Rob with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi, I'm a big fan of the show, big fan of you, Neil, and big fan of Hemingway.
Okay, well, I'm honored to be in such company, but go ahead.
I was curious what you thought about the advent of text messaging and how ubiquitous it's become has sort of pushed the English language more toward languages that are more proprietary in structure, such as French. You know, you wouldn't say something to your boss that you would have said to your best friend for the sheer threat of offending them greatly. And I was wondering if you thought that maybe text messaging was sort of an Americanized version of this.
Yes, it's interesting this. We're talking now about the uses of texts rather than the actual structure of texts. And this is something where, wow, I'm observing changes in this almost, you know, day by day by day. At the beginning, people were very tentative about who they sent a text to. Would you send a text, for example, if you wanted to apply for an interview for a job? Would you send a text if you just had an interview and you wanted to sort of thank the chairman? Would you send a text sending condolences about a death, for instance? And as time goes by, people are learning how far they can push this new technology. The thing you have to remember is that it does have an extraordinarily wonderful range of uses that weren't available before. And I guess one of the best examples is from a few years ago when the Virginia Tech shootings happened, and the university tried to email everybody to warn them about the problem. Well, email, of course, is not a good technology for getting into people's mind straight away. Texting, on the other hand, is a perfect technology.
Actually, I'm a former Virginia Tech student.
And
I was actually outside Norris Hall
whenever
the shootings happened.
And
I had my phone on me, and everyone's parents, everyone, whenever we were, for the hour and a half that all the students were pretty much locked down, I was in a war memorial, which is a gymnasium, and we were just all locked inside the buildings. Everybody was trying to call out, and everyone was trying to call in. And, I mean, this is news that went nation worldwide within a matter of minutes. And you think of how many people you have in your contact list. Imagine all those people trying to call you at once.
Absolutely.
It was almost impossible
to get
a line out. And the one thing that people could actually get through were text messages because they were such a small bit of information.
Absolutely. No, this is a very good point, and this is one of the big features about text and cell phones. They use less bandwidth, and that means any time that the voice system gets clogged up because lots of people are trying to message at the same time, voice might not get through, but texts do. And it doesn't take an event like Virginia Tech to illustrate this. Next New Year's Eve at 12 o'clock, when people are trying to telephone everybody, you know how hard it is to get through, but your texts will get through.
Right, and, you know, texting my mom to tell her I was okay, and the same thing that, you know, every other student did. I mean, those are the most important texts that we sent. And
absolutely.
If it wasn't for that medium, we wouldn't have had that ability.
Yeah, and an awful lot of organizations have introduced that now as a routine feature, I think, as a kind of alerting service. I know there are several parts of the states where, you know, if a child goes missing or something like that, or if there's a burglar in the area, there's a texting service that immediately starts operating so that people can be alerted to the existence of a problem. It's an amazing new development.
Rob, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're going to continue talking with David Crystal about text messaging and, the end of the civilization as we know it. If you'd like to stay with us, call us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll also talk with David Gergen about the transition as you work for one party's president and then come back into the White House and work for another party's president. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're wrapping up our conversation with David Crystal about his book, Texting, The Great Debate. Just before we left, before the break, David Crystal was talking to us about new ways of using text messages and expectations of the medium. And here's a message we got from Twitter from Andrew Holtz, who wrote, "When it's time to stop the string NN2R, no need to respond." Also good to stop to those addicted to reply to all buttons. But that does suggest something about text messages. You do expect a response.
Yes, you do. It's a feature of humanity, isn't it? If you've got a cell phone and it rings or it beeps, you have to reply straight away, don't you? It is inconceivable for you to know that there is a text message coming through and you don't immediately look at it. It just isn't human nature to do anything else. So you look at it and then the pressure is on you to respond. And there is this expectation that there is the need to respond quickly, which doesn't have the same kind of priority when you're talking about, say, emails and so on and so forth. The nearest thing I can think of to text messaging is instant messaging, where, again, everybody is online together, and so you understand that people interact very quickly that way. But with text messaging, yes, you are getting this expectation that a quick response is required. And then if you don't want a response, if the information is just for information, then it's a good idea to let people know that this is the case.
David Crystal, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
David Crystal's book, Texting, The Great Debate, and he joined us online from his home in Wales. And coming up, we'll be talking with David Gergen about working for one administration, then coming back after a few years and working for the administration of another party.